Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hello and welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm your host, Tim Miller. It is Thursday. Usually the Next Level Pod is on Wednesday, but Sarah was traveling, so we did a late night episode that got pretty punchy. So if you're looking for politics and some bickering among friends, that is the place to go. That should be up by the time you hear this. Check out the Next Level feed. On this show, we're getting earnest and activist-y, which you all know is a little bit out of my comfort zone, so I'm excited for it. They are the co-executive directors of Indivisible, the grassroots movement with thousands of local groups across the country. Its mission to elect progressive leaders, rebuild our democracy, and defeat the Trump agenda. The Indivisible protests were the hands-off protests you saw a couple weeks ago, and coming up, the next big one is Saturday, June 14th, where there will be no King's rallies and marches on the day that Trump is throwing himself a birthday military parade. It is Leah Greenberg and Ezra Levin. Which one are we doing? Is it like Mark Levin, like the great one, or Ezra Levin, like Sandy Levin?
You nailed it. First one, Levin.
Levin. I got it right. I am so excited to do this. You guys were in a room together. It was so cute. You're married and you started this together, and we're going to do kind of like a kissing booth type podcast situation. But, you know, for sound purposes, we've had to separate you. And I want to start before we get into the very important work you're doing. Give people the background. How did this happen? What is it like to work with one's spouse in a high stress environment like running protests? Give us the origin story.
So our background is that we both got our start as congressional staffers in the early Obama years on the Hill. Ezra worked for a member from Texas. I worked for a member from a deep red district in Virginia.
We Perriello, both, I saw that.
Tom Perriello,
I worked in that
right.
district back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
You're not going to age me. I was a Republican then, too. So we're not going to talk about it.
Well, we could go into that at a different time. Yeah. Anyways, it was an education in a lot of ways. But the big one was that we interacted a lot with the Tea Party in our jobs. We saw them organize. We disagreed enormously with their bigotry, their violence. But we also saw some very effective organizing tactics. And each of us moved on. We went on to do other things in our lives. I worked on human trafficking. Ezra worked on poverty policy. But after Donald Trump was elected in 2016, we kind of like went back to that period in our lives and thought, hey, there's some lessons that we can learn from this, right? We're in this moment where everything that we care about is under attack. And we've actually just seen a model of what it looks like to organize locally in a way that puts pressure on your local elected officials and significantly impedes the agenda of the other party. And so we basically took all the lessons that we had learned watching the Tea Party operate. We turned it into a how-to guide to organizing locally to stop the Trump agenda. And we put it out on the internet in December 2016. We thought our friends would read it. We thought they would like maybe share it with their families when they went home over Christmas. We were not prepared at all for what happened next, which was that thousands of people started reading it and sharing it and using it as the basis of forming local groups. The title of the guide that we had put out was called Indivisible. Suddenly there were Indivisible groups all over the country who were picking it up and gathering communities and starting to organize and hold their elected officials accountable. And we found ourselves catapulted into this incredible grassroots movement of regular people who were not waiting for Washington to resist, to actually start fighting back, and who were kicking both Democrats and Republicans into gear to push back against Trump.
So this is, we're Thanksgiving 2016, and you guys both have other jobs, and you're married already, or are we just dating?
We are married.
We're married, okay. Yep. And we create a Google Doc That's it. That's how it started.
That's how it started. Yeah. We did not think we were starting an organization. We mostly thought we were going to get fired.
Fired from the jobs that you're in.
Yeah.
What was in the Google Doc? What did it say?
I mean, the Google Doc was 23 pages of how do you organize.
That is type A to start. I mean, you just did a 23 page Google Doc just for shits like that. I don't, it's not in my wheelhouse. I'm more of Twitter length writing.
Tim, you got to remember at the time in late 2016, this is Trump is coming in with a unified Republican Congress promising to repeal the Affordable Care Act. He had future appointees talking about the Japanese internment camps during World War II as a model for what to do with Muslims and immigrants and refugees. People were scared. And there was this organic energy already building, right? And people were looking for, okay, how do we secure our devices? How do we push our elected officials? And Leah and I, being former congressional staffers and having seen the Tea Party in action, we thought, well, look, one thing you can do is get organized locally in a group, focus on your own elected officials and tell them to fight back if they're Democrats and tell them to leave the MAGA coalition if they're Republicans and never give an inch. So the guide explicitly drew from the Tea Party. The first chapter is all about here are lessons from the Tea Party. Here's what we saw. We didn't agree with their bigotry, their racism, and their violence, but damn it, they knew how to organize locally and they knew how to focus on their elected officials. And they didn't win everything, but they were able to stall some things and defeat other things. So look, I mean, we put the Google Doc out. It took off that night. I remember Leah and I, we were like, we did a good thing. It's like people are reading it. This is cool. And then we started getting all these responses that all said the exact same thing, which is this guide that you put out is just absolutely chock full of typos. because that's what you get. But then, as Leah said, what people started doing, they started picking it up and forming these groups. It was an incredible thing. And we, at the bottom of the very first page, at the end of his book, the original one, we said very explicitly, we're not selling t-shirts. We're not forming an organization. Take this and run with it. Good luck to you. And then we formed an organization when there was this incredible outpouring of movement energy. There were all these groups getting started in Tallahassee or in Austin or in Albany. And they were telling us, hey, we just got a group together in our living room. What do we do next?
Yeah, right.
And so we started by just pulling volunteers together and saying, well, we've got to respond to all these people. And then that turned in to the Indivisible National Organization.
So, I mean, I've got listeners that are asking that same question right now. So it's like you're forming groups. You're contacting members, you're showing up to town halls. Like what else was in there?
Well, the basic idea is, you know, we exist in a limited but still real representative democracy in some core ways, right? And so your elected officials care about certain things. They care about getting reelected. They care about their future position. That means they are responsive to some kinds of incentives and not to others, right? They like good attention in their district. They want to maintain that coalition of 50% plus a little bit extra of people who will vote for them. They don't like surprises. They don't like bad press or bad attention. They don't like to waste their time. You can kind of use the incentives to make them either listen to you and do more of what you want, or you can use those same tools to make them pay a political price for not doing so. And that's really the core, right? And that's then you just take the tactics, right? You show up at town halls, you make them answer questions about the things that they don't necessarily want to talk about. You try to shift attention to the issues that you know your fellow constituents are going to care about and respond to. It's all just about how do you systematically move the pieces so that your elected officials have the incentives to do what you want and do less of what you don't want.
So talk about the parallels and differences between that moment and now, right? Because it seems like in that moment, you're kind of like riding this tiger a little bit where there's just all of this outpouring and a lot of people that weren't even paying attention really to politics were wanting to protest and it caught everybody off guard, right? So there's this natural kind of kinetic energy out there. Not for me. I was hiding under the covers, actually. But out there in the world, there were a lot of people that wanted to. I was like reading sad fiction. I was like, I need to check out. But for a lot of other people, they wanted to get out. And this time, it does feel like there's been more of like a need to prod, right? Like that there's people felt a little bit more beaten down. At least that's my perception from the outside. Why don't you guys talk about it, like actually talking to the types of folks that are showing up at these sort of things?
What I would say is really interesting about this moment is from our experience as people who we're the place that you go when you want to do something. And we have been in hyperdrive since November because people have been flooding in and getting organized. We broke the record for new groups in November of 2024 and then broke it again in December. And then every month since then, we've broken it again. There has been a steady build of people organizing on the ground. Now, that hadn't manifested in big protests, the kinds of things that we traditionally associate with 2017. But from our perspective, you know, the early signs of that are someone puts up a Facebook invitation for a meeting and they're expecting 20 people and they get 300. That stuff was happening as of January. So what we saw was, you know, there was definitely a popular reaction that was building and that was forming with some skepticism early on of kind of protest as the mechanism, but a lot of interest in organizing. What was really different about this time was the degree of elite institutional and actor collapse that happened immediately after the election, right? Because regular people were sad, but they were pretty clear that they were going to push back. What changed, what was different was, you know, corporations did not put out the statement saying we stand in solidarity with democracy. You know, Mark Zuckerberg and Jeff Bezos rushed to kind of reach an accommodation with the regime.
Zuckerberg had a struggle session in 2017, right? Like where the whole Facebook staff had to come and talk about their feelings and like they had a meet, you know what I mean? Like that, compare that to giving $1 million and sitting in the front row.
Right, exactly. Well, and media institutions, you know, a lot of the corporate media institutions kind of moved in very quickly into how do we accommodate? How do we comply? How do we avoid what's coming at us personally? Like what we saw in general was regular people were pretty clear that they were going to push back. And it was actually the, you know, the kinds of institutions that we think of as like shaping meaning for society that folded very, very swiftly. And a lot of what we've been trying to do over the last couple of months is really dispute the foundations that led to that happening and push as much as we can the rest of society back into that posture of opposition.
Yeah, I do wonder, Ezra, what do you think just, and add on to that anything, but just on one specific point, you know, look, like obviously people that are really engaged, activists, news consumers, people that listen to political podcasts, right? Like have been engaged in showing up to these things. Like to me, I do wonder, and it's kind of hard, you know, like, I don't know, you're at the events more than me, right? It's hard unless I'm like interviewing strangers at the events and be like, where, what's your story? It does feel like maybe there was a little bit of a gap between like engaged people who are opposed and want to do something versus like casuals, if you will. But maybe that's wrong. I don't know. What do you think?
That's always going to be true. That was true in 2016 too, Tim. Yeah. There were a lot of people who were hyper-focused on politics who immediately after election were shocked, had wished they had done more. And so what they did in some cases were form a local indivisible group, get their community together. Like Leah said, you know, days after the election, we left our kids with my mom and then went to a cabin in West Virginia to write the new indivisible guide and then put it out. The following week, we had tens of thousands of people join that call to find out what can I do in this moment. So there was a real gap between how the broader media was covering the reaction to Trump's reelection and how a lot of folks on the ground were responding to it. Like, look, we had more indivisible groups form in November than any month since 2017 when protest was the new brunch. We beat the November number in December. We beat the December number in January. We beat the combined number of new local indivisible groups from November, December, and January in February, and then beat that number in March. So what we were witnessing as organizers on the ground were a lot of folks who were flipping out, but they weren't hiding. They were trying to grapple with the situation, and what they were doing was organizing on the ground. And they were responding to two things. One was the heinous Trump agenda and the promises that this administration and the Congress were making at the time and then proceeded to implement. But the other was the sense of fecklessness and leaderlessness at the national level from the Democratic Party, the sense that, wait a minute, we were campaigning against this guy's Mussolini for 2 years, and suddenly after the election, you switch over and act like, oh, he's just another Republican and we're going to cut deals with him. What the hell is this? So we saw Democratic leadership pivot, and rank and file Democrats were like, absolutely not. We've got to organize against this guy. And I think those two features, which were somewhat similar to 2016, drove this wave of engagement that was largely behind the scenes up until February. Because in February was congressional recess. And then suddenly in February, all the headlines were about where the hell did all these people come? They're in Republican districts and they're in Democratic districts. And they're angry with Democrats for not fighting back. And they're angry with Republicans for backing up Musk and Trump. This is amazing. I guess the resistance isn't dead. But for the month from November, December, and January, I can't tell you how many journalists I talked to were like, well, obviously the resistance is dead. There's not going to be any opposition. Right. And y'all screwed this up.
Yeah.
So it's been an interesting journey these last 6 months. But we're a hell of a lot better off right now than we were 6 months ago.
Yeah, this is usually a doomer pod, but I'm going to try to stay positive. because there are some positive things, right? Like, and I'm curious what you guys see as successes, right? So if you look back on 2018, like obviously the Obamacare is a success, right? Stopping the Obamacare repeal. The child separation, I think, is one that stands up, is one that they had to pull back on. Looking at now, and this is more modest because it's early, but just listening to you, like, Democratic politicians are getting more backbone now, in response to hearing from people, hearing from their own voters, and like realizing what they want. So that's in some ways a success, right? Because that's what you want them to have, more backbone. So what else are you seeing out there that is encouraging?
Elon Musk is leaving the White House with his tail between his legs. We kicked his ass up and down Wisconsin in a Supreme Court race. Donald Trump's approval rating is at 40%. I mean, I don't know. What we see is the wheels are coming off of this administration, and maybe not fast enough. Like, we can be doomer. We are in a dire position right now. We are in a constitutional crisis. We're in a period of authoritarian breakthrough. We haven't won yet, but the big bright silver lining out there is, as institutions like media institutions or law firms or some universities are falling, we're seeing a historic level of pro-democracy grassroots engagement. And when you listen to the experts in authoritarianism, what they tell you you need as a bulwark for democracy, you need people, normal everyday people, organizing a broad-based, ideologically diverse, geographically distributed movement of pro-democracy people organizing. That's what works. That's what saves democracy. There's no other silver bullet out there. So that's what should give us optimism. Not that Donald Trump is suddenly going to see the light of day, or that a lot of Republicans are going to join you, Tim.
Sure.
But that normal people are organizing against one of the most unpopular policy agendas and most aggressively anti-democracy administrations in American history. That's pretty cool. And if we can build that, that's the solution.
Leah, you got anything to add to that?
Well, I think there's a direct relationship, or there's a complex but very interactive relationship between kind of the mass opposition and these institutions, right? So one thing that I've heard from multiple people who are a part of the Harvard organizing efforts to try to make sure that Harvard was standing up and pushing back against the Trump administration's efforts to functionally take it over, was the environment changed dramatically after Hands Off, right? Big public shows of opposition helped to reinforce so many people who are organizing in places that we don't necessarily have eyes into. We can't run the campaign, but they are either helped or hurt by the overall environment that we create. And fundamentally, we're in this moment that we describe as authoritarian breakthrough, right? It's a period where a regime tries to very rapidly push its powers to the max in order to consolidate and cow alternate sources of power into opposition. And every other alternate source of power, right? Businesses, higher education, media institutions, et cetera, they're making calculations based on whether they think this is the new normal or whether they think maybe this is a short-term emergency and democracy will reassert itself. And it's our job to introduce into their minds the very clear possibility that democracy will reassert itself, that there is going to be a massive popular reaction to this regime that ensures that it cannot consolidate power, that it cannot become the new normal, and that they have to make decisions about how they're going to, you know, how they're going to go along with it or how they're going to push back, that they have to live with in either situation, not just in the situation where Trump, you know, takes over, consolidates, and becomes the ultimate dictator.
For the longtime listeners, our adventure with Aretha, the neighborhood cat, who's become my part-time cat, continues, thanks to our sponsor, Smalls. You know, we were feeding the neighborhood cat some food. Then the snowstorm, the 100-year snowstorm in New Orleans happened, and I was stuck in New York. My husband and child brought the cat inside, and the cat was inside a lot. And the cat must like summer, because summer happens. Now the cat likes to be outside. Got to tell you, I don't hate that, but you know, the cat's still coming. Yesterday, or 2 days ago, whenever it was, during the Nuggets game, I was yelping, and it freaked out the cat so much that the only thing to get it to calm down was shaking the little bag of Smalls treats. And if you want that experience for your cat, I'd recommend turning to Smalls as well. This podcast is sponsored by Smalls. If you're a listener of the show, you know that my cat cannot live without Smalls. To get 35% off plus an additional 50% off your first order, head to smalls.com and use our promo code THEBULWARK for a limited time only. Smalls cat food is protein-packed recipes made with preservative-free ingredients you'd find in your fridge, and it's delivered right to your door. That's why Cats.com named Smalls their best overall cat food. We also gave the Smalls food to another friend who has another neighborhood cat. I don't know what it says about New Orleans that there's so many neighborhood cats. Also loving it. So we're just spreading the love all around uptown. The neighborhood cats have never been better fed here in New Orleans. Smalls has a bunch of amazing treats and snacks you can add to your order. And the team at Smalls is so confident your cat will love their product that you can try it risk-free. That means they'll refund you if your cat won't eat their food. What are you waiting for? Give your cat the food they deserve for a limited time only. Because you are a Bulwark listener, you can get 35% off Smalls, plus an additional 50% off your first order by using my code, TheBulwark. That's an additional 50% off when you head to smalls.com and use promo code, TheBulwark. Again, that's promo code, TheBulwark, for an additional 50% off your first order, plus free shipping at smalls.com. I want to do one more positive on that front before I get to some of my concerns, because we saw some, so I'm in Louisiana. Leah and I were talking about why we were making Ezra move to a different room. We had these like ballot initiatives that were, I don't know if this was even on your radar, because it's like very local. And it was the governor here, who's a MAGA guy, was pushing these ballot initiatives that were kind of arcane, really, and like what it was going to do. It was not like a easy to understand issue, like a minimum wage increase or something. It was like these changes with, you know, his control over the judiciary and the tax system. And what you saw was just like this grassroots outpouring against it. And you saw two things happening at the same time, like, which is massive turnout in big Democratic areas. So like New Orleans' turnout was like 62% or something, and it was 27% the rest of the state. And you saw, just a shout out to my people, like the people that did leave the Republican Party that came to this are all like hyper engaged types. Like the new Democratic coalition includes people who like do show up to these off year elections, like random elections that like that folks aren't aware of unless you're like really paying close attention. And I do think that you're seeing like that, that is something that can be, you know, catalyzed, right? And you have these sorts of like random elections in a lot of places. And I just wonder what you guys are doing to kind of play off of that.
Absolutely. We have got a coalition that we've got work to do for the general elections. And also it is extremely well optimized to maximize gains in off-year special elections, in midterms, et cetera, anytime when you're going to depend on a motivated voting base. So I think the big opportunity that's coming up is Virginia and New Jersey, right? We're going to have these elections in the fall. They're going to be the first pretty decisive opportunities to further repudiate Trumpism, to demonstrate that this doesn't play across the board. That's especially important because, you know, New Jersey got closer than people would have liked to see in 2024, right? And so these are two states that are, you know, where the margins are going to matter for demonstrating for people exactly how much of a political penalty they're going to pay for continuing to be on board here. So we're working with our folks. We're organizing already. We tested in 2024 and are continuing to hone and roll out a technology that allows us to send folks to talk to their immediate neighbors, low information or low turnout voters who we think will vote with us if turned out, literally within their neighborhood. We saw that the work, we've done that over a couple of cycles with some really exciting results. And so we're continuing to work on, you know, how do we make sure that we take the energy that we have from regular people and translate it into ways to reach people that break through the ads, that break through kind of the social media chaos, and actually reach them as regular human beings through relationships.
Okay, so here's some things that to be, you know, concerned about. I'm interested how you guys are, what you're seeing. We're talking about so many things to be concerned about. That's not good. I'm not covering them all with you because you're activists. So we're not going to go over all the policy. I have a lot of policy concerns. Do you have any thoughts on the tariffs? Not much about the economic collapse impending. We did that on Tuesday. The fear. So I was on a panel recently. I was getting questions. There's a woman who raised her hand who says, my daughter is in college. I forgot where she's going. And her and her friends are like kind of scared to protest, right? And like, they don't know, you know, if they got friends who are here on a foreign visa, they don't want to put their head up, they don't, you know. And I'm just wondering, like, how much of that are you kind of seeing out there?
Unfortunately, that's understandable. This guy is not a normal Republican president. This administration is not leading like a normal conservative government. It's not just something that we disagree with ideologically on education and economic policy. There's an attack on the basic norms of liberal democracy right now. I would love to be able to tell everybody out there that, don't worry about it. It's not serious. You don't have to be concerned. But the whole idea of the authoritarian playbook is to attack dissent, is to marginalize it, is to make people fearful that if they speak up, there might be consequences. And there is no foolproof plan to address that on our side other than strength in numbers, other than getting as many people out to accept some level of risk personally and to stand up for democracy. I think this is, you know, not to get too schmaltzy about it, but it's one of the inspiring things that we experience every week working with Indivisible leaders. These are not hardened politicos. These aren't professional employed politicians. These are nurses and teachers and IT technicians. They're normal everyday people out in blue, red, and purple states and rural communities and urban communities. And they see what's going on and they're deciding to take on risk in order to stand up for their values. And because they are doing it, other people see them do it and get the courage to do it too. The kind of the bumper sticker, courage is contagious, is a bumper sticker, but it's also true. And it applies not just to individuals, it applies to institutions, as Leo was talking about. Universities are looking left and right. Law firms are looking left and right. Politicians are looking left and right and trying to think, well, how safe is it for me to show up? Is my neighbor showing up? Are my constituents showing up? Are my students showing up? Oh, okay, I guess I should show up. It's a classic collective action problem. You need a lot of people to act, and it's in everybody's individual interest to hide under the covers. And so our job is to try to make it as easy and as safe as we possibly can make it for more people to come up. Because if they do, then it is safe. Then we are in the majority. Then they are marginalized. Then it is foreign and untenable for them to crack down on peaceful protest. But the fear is real, but that's the plan. That is their goal, is to spread that fear.
The fear is real. The risk is real, but it's not evenly distributed. Like, all of us are, in fact, under threat. I want to be clear that we are indeed all under threat. We're not all under threat in the same ways at the same times. And so one of the things that I think I am seeing a lot of is people who are recognizing, you know, maybe that foreign student who's on a visa, maybe they can't be the one leading the protest right now. That's why I'm an older, white, college educated person. I got to show up. I got to put myself on the line here. We've heard from a lot of people who understand that because they don't have quite as many risk factors right now for themselves personally, it is more incumbent on them to step forward. And I think that's really important and powerful.
I totally agree with that. And I try to spread that message as much as possible. I worry, I'm going to give you guys a chance to critique us in the kind of anti-Trump media a little bit. I worry that the doomerism like has a negative effect on people actually showing up. Like, I get comments and questions like, Tim, it's like, we're not even going to have elections in 2028 and like, it's fucking over. And I worry about this, right? I think that a lot of times we're covering things that are legitimate things to be concerned about. It's kind of hard in a media pundit space to contextualize something that's a 15% risk, right? Like a 15% risk that we don't have an election in 2028 is really bad. And it's much higher than, 0% my entire life, and now it's 15%, but it's still only 15%, right? It's not like 85%, but the people listening. So I do kind of worry that like the bubble of anti-Trump media gets people into an unhealthy place. I don't know. What do you guys make of that?
I think it's only unhealthy if people's only experience with politics is as a consumer of political media. I think it's important to consume political media to become informed about the world. Like, you want to know what's going on. But what we advise people to do is not just be a consumer. Politics should not be something that you just treat as a TV show that you watch, that you are not some sort of victim of world events. You are an active participant in it. And so by all means, listen to The Bulwark, listen to Tim, you'll get informed, you'll learn about the world. That is great. But don't shut it off and then go to your next task. Think about, what do you do with that information? And so for us, our unit of activism is not the individual. Our unit of activism is the local group. We've got a couple thousand local Indivisible groups spread across every congressional district in the country. And that's important because those groups foster action. They don't exist just to talk about political media. They exist to focus on, where do we have leverage? Maybe our Republican senator doesn't give a shit about us. Okay, we're not going to push them now. But maybe we've got a city council person or a state legislature or a U.S. rep or a governor. We can push there. Let's talk about how we collectively use our power. What's the next thing we're doing? Is there a march that we're showing up? Is there an op-ed that we can write? Is there a town hall we can go to? But taking that step from being informed to action, Those two things go together. I don't want people taking action if they're not informed. And I also don't want people to just be informed for the sake of being depressed about the state of the world.
I'd also just add, like, I think we have this very tricky messaging balance to land all of us in media or advocacy, right? Because we kind of need people to live in two worlds at the same time. We need them to live in the world where normal advocacy, normal elections are real and are happening and matter and invest in that world and insist on that world, right? Because a really, really bad outcome is one where everybody just kind of assumes that elections are off the table and won't happen anymore, right? If they do try to steal elections, we need people to be outraged as if it had never occurred to them that this was an option at all. So we need people to live in that normal world, and we also need them to live in a world where there is a regime that's rapidly trying to consolidate power. And we have to look at, like, what are the tactics? What are the ways in which you organize as, you know, a nonviolent social movement that's trying to prevent that consolidation of power? And some of those overlap and some of them are different.
I make a meta comment? We don't do a ton of interviews together. And it's kind of funny because Lee and I play very different roles in the organization. She's like the brilliant strategy and thinker, and I'm like the enthusiast. And I think it's on full display in this interview.
That's so real.
I'm loving it. I also noticing you guys, since you said that you do your little team meetings in the room together, mm-hmm. we're just kind of looking at each other, and now we've separated you. And I kind of notice Ezra like looking over to be like, is this a you? And it's like, wait a minute, we're not,
normally like nudging each other, you know, like, I want this question, or, you know, so now we have to like use
it. It is cute. Let's do strategy then. So we'll go to Leah, since you're the strategist. One thing that I just wonder, and when I was watching the hands-off protests, is like there's this balance, right? Like, it's like, on the one hand, that's a vague big umbrella, right, that everybody can kind of feel like they fit under, whether they're a former Republican or a communist, you know? On the other hand, like, if you look at protests that have been really catalyzing in the past, like, it's usually like about something, right? George Floyd, the Tea Party was kind of broad, but it was like ostensibly about spending, right? You know, March for Our Lives, school shootings, right? How do you guys balance that right now? And how are you thinking about it? And are you thinking that you need to find a catalyzing event, or that you're thinking you're trying to keep it as broad as possible?
The answer is kind of yes and yes, both. Yeah. An initial assumption we had heading into this period was that protests would be more touched off by specific events, catalyzing events during this time. And what we've seen is that the speed at which they are moving, right, they're doing this kind of warp speed, running through a bunch of very, very awful and unpopular things very swiftly, makes it hard for individual things that should be massive era-defining developments to break through, right? You get rid of the Department of Education, that should be the only thing anyone talks about for like a month.
Had George Bush done that in 2001, you know, it'd be the only thing that everybody's protesting on until 9/11 happened, I guess. But you know what I mean? Like, in a different time, right?
Exactly. So our strategy with Hands Off was to, you know, to articulate an emotion that everyone was feeling, regardless of what specific thing was bringing them to that moment, right? Whether it was the attack on Social Security and Medicare, whether it was an attack on our civil rights, whether it was the attack on immigrants in our communities, articulate that kind of collective sense of loss aversion and wed it to a story that could hold us all, right? It's, you know, they are out of control. They're wrecking the things we care about, and they are doing it to benefit themselves, and then push together. And, you know, there may well be moments in the future that do break through as that catalyzing moment. And then we're kind of in a rapid response mobilizing around that. But for now, what we're seeing is working is giving people the container that holds the collective sense of chaos and harm and destruction and gives people a space for outrage and pushing back. And we did that with, you know, that was the thinking behind the hands-off framing. That's the thinking behind the No Kings framing as well, right? We're creating a container that's big enough to hold anybody who's like, this guy has gone too far. We're not trying to say, you know, here's our entire issues platform, but we are saying, you know, we are all under attack and we're all showing up to push back on this autocratic, imperious, corrupto rule.
Yeah. And the Elon thing was maybe felt like for a moment that could be it, but now maybe he's going back. I don't know. Ezra, what do you think about that? I know some level of the No Kings, I wonder, is like, will some people be like, well, he's not a king. You know, again, is this a play to just people that are really focused? I don't know.
Look, there is such power in no. There is such power in no. And when you look across the world at creeping authoritarianism and the movements that pushed back successfully against them, they did not agree on what the ruling party should do after the authoritarian was taken down. They didn't. And that's really important. We've got to recognize a hard political truth. We lost the White House. We lost the House. We lost the Senate. The orange guy with tiny hands sets the agenda every week. Whatever he posts on Truth Social, suddenly that's what we're talking about. That's the consequences of being wiped out in 2024 at the national level. So we have the ability to respond. That's what we have the ability to do. We can respond to the agenda that's being put forward. And your response can be, well, let's see how we can cut some deals. Maybe we can work with them. Or it could be, fuck no. We're not going along with this guy. We're not allowing him to concentrate power further in the White House. We are in the fuck no category, and we are trying to build a unified opposition party that says no. And that unified opposition party should include you, Tim. It should include the socialists in DSA. It should include Matt Iglesias. It should include liberals, and it should include progressives. We can all agree right now that the political question of the day, which is, do we want more authoritarianism or don't we? We can all have the same answer to that. And then we can fight it out in 2029 when we have a unified democratic control of the government. That's great. Let's fight then. But right now, to build a mass movement, being able to say, do you want a king? Is a king something you want in America? Well, this guy is spending $50 million, taxpayer dollars, on a military parade on his birthday on June 14th. I'm going to put tanks through the street of DC. Is that something you want while he comes after your Social Security, your Medicaid, your Medicare? Well, a very big coalition can say no to that. And our plan is to have, I don't know, 1,000, 2,000 protests around the world on that day, everywhere but DC. And it's going to be driven by normal people who say, nah, I don't want kings. I might not agree on economic policy. I might not agree on education policy. But you know what I do agree with these DSA folks on? I don't want kings. You know what I agree with Tim on? I don't want kings. That's great. And then we can fight it out after we actually have a liberal democracy that responds to the will of the people on what the future proactive policy agenda ought to be.
Yeah. I don't want any kings. I don't want this fucking king in particular.
There we go.
As well, we can start there. So I do another show that's focused on getting Gen Z folks involved. We have only Gen Z guests with Cam Caskey, who did March for Our Lives. And he's like, I didn't feel like my networks were very engaged on Hands Off on the first round, right? And I don't mean this as a criticism. It's just like kind of a reality. They're getting information differently. You look at the pictures from the protests, and it does seem to be kind of a lot of more older folks, right? That which is a little different, right? At least for, you know, that's not different throughout all of history, but it's different to, like, through our lives, right? Like, most of the big protests we've seen have kind of been, you know, it's been younger folks that have been driving them, or the front faces of them, at least. Why do you think that is? Are you worried about it? Are you thinking about how to engage younger people differently?
It's a great question. And we've seen the same pictures. And, you know, it's a live conversation within our own network as well, right? Because we do have to tend to have folks who are millennial, who are baby boomer, who are Gen X as kind of our core organizing cadre. And so who's, you know, kind of how Gen Z moves into action is definitely a live question. And I do think that, you know, there's a bunch of complicated and intersecting stuff here, right? Like this is a generation whose formative years were derailed by COVID in a way that wasn't true for someone who was, you know, 30 or older when COVID hit. This is a generation that's been shaped by watching the catastrophic events unfold in the Middle East over the last couple of years and by the Biden administration's response. And, you know, I think we've got to note that, like, the most visible, like, mass demonstration of youth over the last couple of years has been the pro-Palestine movement, right? Has been the anti-genocide movement. And so there are, in fact, young people who are out there. And we actually, you know, figure this is, again, where we talk about, like, what is the big tent, right? So I think there's a piece of this that's about, you know, how do you engage young people who have generally experienced the system as one that has not served them, and so are not moved by appeals around institutions, are not moved by appeals around, you know, reclaiming and protecting a democracy that they perceive as not having worked for them. That's not unique to young people, right? Like, that's the million-dollar question for a lot of voters who we lost in 2024, but I think it's particularly notable with them.
I'd add one other element to that, Ezra. I'm curious your take on this. I'd say answer anything on that, but specifically on the Trump question, because it relates to the no kings framing. I think part of it is just that, like, our age and up, he's more of an aberration, right? And so using him as the catalyst is going to work more. I don't know. I was speaking to high school at my high school when I was home a couple of weeks ago. you know, the linear nature of time is confusing. And I was like talking about the 2016 campaign, you know, and like one of the kids raised their hand was asking like an obvious question about the 2016 campaign. I appreciate all obvious questions, but then I was like, wait a minute. So how old were you then? And he was like 7, you know, and I'm going, oh, right.
Oh,
like a
gosh.
Sophomore in high school or a freshman or a junior in high school or whatever was 7 during the 2016 campaign. And so they don't have any framework. So I do wonder if that is like part of the challenge, right? Like figuring out some other way that besides Trump bad. I don't know. What do you think about that?
God, that's so tragic, Tim. That just makes me sad that there's a generation of people who are growing up where Trump is normal. Trump is reality, and he defines a political era. We got to make it so that's not normal. We've got to get beyond this era. There has to be an era of accountability after this, where we make very clear that people who go along with the demolishing of our institutions face consequences, and that that is not something that we as a society accept. God, that makes me so sad to think of young people growing
up. You want to keep getting sad? His picture is going to be in the classroom 2 times when your kid goes to school. So anyway, just on little president poster on the wall.
Thanks for that, Tim.
That's my job here. That's my job here.
Wow.
You guys are the earnest cheerleader. Right. Let's go protest. I'm like, yeah, here we go. Here's a reality bomb.
Our kids are 2 years old and 4 years old. So Zeke, the older one, was at the protest when we defeated Trump, which was glorious. And he only knows Trump as the guy, the bad guy who wants to take my toys. And the 2-year-old doesn't know anything. Yeah. And actually, an increasing number of Americans are knowing him as the bad guy who wants to take your dolls, which is great. It's a pretty accurate assessment and more accurate than.
It's good. Maybe Gen Alpha will have a more coherent Trump as evil worldview than the Gen Zs.
If we're successful, the story of this period is going to be that time when America faced some scary authoritarian threat, but ultimately we overcame it and we reasserted democracy. And that's the future that we're aiming for. I do think it is really important that we don't just get the Merrick Garlands of the world in power again in 2029 and decline to actually prosecute these assholes who are demolishing our institutions. And I think it's actually important not just to have a democratic trifecta in 2029, but to start talking about an accountability agenda now. Because we want those institutions and those leaders who are considering going along with this guy to think, oh no, if the Democrats win and it looks like they're going to, I might face consequences. I might actually have to face a committee and talk about how I helped implement a deportation agenda that kidnapped Americans and sent them to a work camp in El Salvador. I want leaders making that choice. I want airplane pilots deciding whether or not to take off to be thinking about that when they choose whether or not to help this authoritarian. But on Gen Z, the thing I was going to say, I think we suck at reaching Gen Z where they are. As a pro-democracy movement at the Democratic Party, I think we're just getting our clock cleaned by the other side. I think, and that's
Charlie Kirk is just better at this. I hate to give give him credit, but it's like, you have to actually try. How did Charlie Kirk get better at it? He fucking tried. He like, you know, he did the same thing you guys did, but just with a focus on campus, and like trying actually matters.
So we just hired on somebody from NextGen, one of the lead youth organizers, to lead up our new media operations, specifically with an eye for, look, we don't know what the hell we're doing in this. We're not doing it well right now. How can we do better? How can we actually reach out to different audiences? Because I love getting quoted in New York Times or Washington Post or in MSNBC. That's great. It's not enough to reach the populations we need to reach. We need to figure out how to reach out to new and emerging media.
I totally agree with all of that, especially the accountability part, which I didn't ask about, but you know how to pander to the podcast to this because I'm with you on that. The immigration thing. That's the other, I think it's a strategic question kind of, right? Because this is the thing that pisses me off the most, right? Like it's the thing that gets my blood boiling. It's the fact that it's us, it's our government that has kidnapped people and put them in a fucking hole in El Salvador. It's our government that took a 19-year-old who came here when she was 4, but she didn't commit any crimes consciously. And now she's shackled in a fucking cell in Georgia because she did a right on a no right turn traffic light that happened yesterday. So that's what pisses me off the most. But like, I don't know. Is it maybe not strategically right to get into just an immigration frame, you know, because of that broad tent? How can you take these horror stories and use them to appeal to a broader group and have it not just be a straight immigration protest? Do you guys think about that at all?
Well, we think that it's a core part of the story, right? Because you can't separate this kind of escalation of a deportation agenda from the broader attack on democracy and civil rights, right? Like the same tools, the same vehicles, the same people are being used for both. the same threats are being applied to both, right? When they take innocent people and consign them to a torture camp in El Salvador, they're trying to create the conditions that cause a lot of immigrants in this country to leave because that threat, that fear is so great. That is it's an intentional strategy to create fear amongst our immigrant neighbors. It's also an intentional strategy to create fear amongst the rest of us, right? Like the idea, the threat behind we might put American citizens in El Salvador is aimed at everyone who might oppose the regime in any possible way. And so I think that we have to fold these stories together. We have to recognize that, you know, the ways in which they are going after immigrant communities in this country are actually the preview and the same kind of coercive machinery that they intend to apply to the rest of us. And that fighting back against these kinds of attacks is actually core to what we are collectively doing. I don't think it's a matter of framing it as, you know, an immigration issue or a not immigration issue. It's a matter of what are our values? What are our rights? What are our expectations for everybody who lives in this country? And are we going to stand behind that? And what kind of country are we going to be?
This pisses me off so much because you can almost hear the Democratic political consultants talking to elected officials and saying, look, we pulled this issue and immigration is lower, therefore don't talk about immigration. And then you see it in their actions and their speeches. Not everybody, obviously, there are a lot of good ones, but look, Joe Rogan is pissed off about this. There are plenty of Republicans and conservatives and non-politicos who see this and say, wait, they're fucking kidnapping people? Are you kidding me? They're just taking them off the street, not giving them any due process and sending them to a labor camp in El Salvador. This is wild. You know what? We don't have to agree on path to citizenship, on border security, on broader comprehensive immigration reform to say, hey, you know what? The federal government shouldn't be kidnapping people off of the street, because if they can do that to somebody who's brown, they can do it to me too. Like that is crazy that any Democrat would say this is a losing position for us. They're thinking about it in these like 1990s political terms, and we just live in a completely different environment now. I see a lot of fighters in the Democratic Party, and we're trying to support those fighters. I think it's the right thing to do, because I don't think we should be terrorizing any populations in this country. But I also think it's the politically advantageous thing to do. Not kidnapping people is a pretty good political slogan. You can build a pretty broad-based constituency off of, let's not kidnap people.
Right. I'm trying to fit in with my new progressive friends. I'm snapping at you right now. I'm snapping. We're doing snaps.
That's it. Thanks. That's great. You're doing a great job.
All right, guys. Do you guys ever fight?
All the time. Fight?
I'm trying to think about doing something with my husband. Tell me a story about a bicker that you guys did.
Oh, never write a book with your spouse. Yes. That was the most that we're both very opinionated writers. Yeah. I write a lot, and then Leah kills all of what I've written, and it's traumatic.
It's true. He writes a lot, and I am the editor, and then we get into pretty extended.
Was there ever a guest room sleeping situation during the editing process?
But there is this thing that happened in what it was 2017, 2018, Leah, that I think of a lot, because I think it is a good representation of the roles that we play in the organization. We use like an internal communication Slack platform to talk internally with the team. And somebody proposed that we do something. I don't even remember what it was. It was a strategic play. And Leah and I both responded at the same time. And Leah wrote, maybe, but let's run the traps on this. And I wrote, fuck it, let's do it and be legends. And I actually do think that healthy tension has been beneficial to the organization, because you do need both of those impulses.
Well, and I also think I'm not advocating that the future of, you know, nonprofit leadership is people who are married to each other running organizations. But there are actually real advantages. Being the head of an organization it's hard, and there's not enough hours in the day, and it's lonely. And I don't really understand how anyone does it as an individual. And I also don't understand how co-executive directors can do it if they're not married to each other, because you kind of need that foundation of unconditional love if you're going to make it through the moments that are tough.
Are you ever like watching Severance and one of you is like bringing up a staffing issue and the other one's like, will you just shut the fuck up about this for a second? I'm trying to have 30 minutes of peace.
We literally last night watching Andor, literally that happened.
Yeah, this is true.
Okay. Well, good luck with that. I got to tell you, better you than me, I guess is all I'm saying. I'm in a very great marriage, but the separate roles and responsibilities are also important, but I'm happy it's working for you guys. I'm just so impressed with you. I'm so happy y'all are doing it, and thank you for coming on the pod. Folks can go check out the groups Indivisible. It seems like you've got groups everywhere, but you know, if we got a listener in a place where you don't have a group, they can start one.
Please.
Yeah,
and the King's Day, what is it again? June 14th?
June 14th, Donald Trump's birthday, 79th birthday, military parade in DC, protest literally everywhere else.
All right. I don't know where the hell I am June 14th. Wherever I am, I'll be at one.
There will be one near you, I guarantee it.
We can promise.
I look forward to it, and let's stay in touch, all right?
Thanks, Tim.
Everybody else, come back tomorrow for another edition of the Borg Podcast. It will be less earnest, and I promise you there'll be more doomerism, and we'll see y'all then. Peace. Podcast is produced by Katie Cooper with audio engineering and editing by Jason Brown.